It's the Kim Munson Show, analyzing the most important stories.
That seems to me like government is establishing a religion.
The latest in politics and world affairs.
If you give people rights, women's rights, gay rights, whatever, there can't be equal rights if there's special rights.
Today's current opinions and ideas.
Surveys show that people still really prefer freedom versus force.
Is it freedom or is it force? Let's have a conversation.
Indeed. Let's have a conversation and welcome to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Thank you so much for joining us. Each of you, you're treasured, you're valued, you have a purpose, strive for excellence, live with intention, and take care of your heart, your soul, your mind, and your body. I so appreciate you joining us today. On this show, we are searching for truth and clarity on these issues that are facing our communities, our state, and our nation, and our world. And our hope is that as we search for truth and clarity, looking at through this lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom, that this will help you get your brain around these issues so that you can converse with your friends and your family and your colleagues about this, because we are engaged in a big battle of ideas. And thank you to each and every one of you who contribute to keep this show on the air, as well as I have great advertising sponsorship partners, and one of them is in studio with me right now, and this is Lauren Levy. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Glad to be back.
And you are a specialist in the mortgage market. Polygon Financial Group is your company, and you sponsor both this show and America's Veteran Stories, and so you're a great partner of the show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I'm glad to be involved.
And in the second segment, we'll be talking about mortgages, the housing market, and you have some new light to shed on something we were talking about last week with Karen Levine and Lee Brown regarding these big investors that are coming in and buying homes. So stay tuned. People will find out about that in the second segment. Yesterday, we'd gone off the air and the phone rang, and it was one of you listeners to let us know we neglected to mention that it was Flag Day yesterday. And so it was Flag Day. It was my good friend Sue's birthday. It was Donald Trump's birthday. And thank you for reminding us. Patty actually had it on the outline that it was Flag Day. So that is on me. I missed it. Steve, you're shaking your head.
Well, it was on both of us. Like you said, Patty had it in plain view. But with my alarm clock woes and the elevator situation, I was just a little too...
You were focused on something else.
Too frazzled.
I was just jumping in on all these headlines. So, and it's actually a long story. I have it on the outline. We're not going to go through it all. But I guess to kind of begin with, though, in the Revolutionary War, each different not state, but now, well, what would I call them? Each
colony,
I guess that's what it was. Actually, they each had their own flag. So George Washington wanted to bring them all under the same flag. So hence we got the Betsy Ross flag. But then just check it out. There's a long story about Flag Day. So yesterday was Flag Day. Our quote for today is very, very heady. And I was looking for socialism quotes because we'll be talking with Josh Philip. He's an award-winning investigative journalist with the Epoch Times and the host of Crossroads in the third and fourth segment. And he said there's this grassroots movement to defeat socialism here in America. And so I thought, well, I'm going to go to some socialism quotes. And a great place to go is certainly the guys with Hitler, because Nazi stands for the National Socialist Democrat Workers Party. And, right? Did I get that right? I think I did. And anyway, Joseph Goebbels was a German Nazi politician, and he was the Nazi Geleiter of Berlin, the chief propagandist for the Nazi Party, and then Reich Minister of Propaganda from 1933 to 1945. He was one of Adolf Hitler's closest and most devoted acolytes, known for his skills in public speaking and his deeply virulent anti-Semitism, which was evident in his publicly voiced views. He was born in 1897. He died in 1945 from suicide. And this is, I found it fascinating, because in America, we have in our Constitution that we have that government shall institute no religion. Freedom of religion is what it's called. And this is what Goebbels said. He said, what does Christianity mean today? He says, National Socialism is a religion. All we lack is a religious genius capable of uprooting outmoded religious practices and putting new ones in their place. We lack traditions and ritual. One day soon, National Socialism will be the religion of all Germans. My party is my church, and I believe I serve the Lord, which would be his party, best if I do his will and liberate my oppressed people from the fetters of slavery. This is my gospel. Do you not find so interesting in this, Steve, all these different words, these words that really, well, we see these words now all the time, oppressed, slavery, socialism. I thought that it was just a really interesting quote. Your thoughts, Steve?
Well, I'm sure propaganda or the origins of it were used before the Nazi Party came to power in history, but they certainly perfected it. They used it as a weapon, and the words that you just read are kind of chilling in a way. It's when he talks about his Lord and the gospel, he's making a dual meaning out of it and trying to sound like he's legitimate.
Right. And there's all of this conversation now, particularly with critical race theory, about oppressed and oppressors. I think you can see so many of these words that are being used today. Lauren, what's your thoughts on this?
Well, I just find it interesting that he's, like Steve said, he's using dual definitions, kind of like bringing religious terms into a political situation, to try to further confuse or, get people to buy into what he's thinking.
Right. And words are so important. We're in this big battle of ideas right now, and words are so important. I've told this story before, but Justice Scalia was in town, obviously, before he died, and I went to the luncheon, and I've been thinking a lot about this in the Constitution, the freedom of religion, but the government shall not use their power, basically, to force a religion. And so I asked him, I said that if you take the definition of religion, which is a belief system, and you say that government is not supposed to push a certain belief system, but you look at like wokeism now or environmentalism or all of these things that are at the forefront, that seems to me that it's become a religion for people now. And they are using government to force that religion. They're using taxpayer dollars to force that religion. So anyway, I asked Justice Scalia about that, if it's a belief system and we're using government money to push forward these policies, is that not unconstitutional? And his response to me was cute. but I've thought that this is kind of the new religion, and I think the founding fathers, Lauren, they realized that there was such danger in people using government to force a belief system.
I'll be honest, I hadn't thought of it like that, so that's very interesting that you say that.
So you're saying cute.
Yeah. No, just I have to give it more thought. Okay. I just, this whole woke thing, I just kind of deflect it, but you really can't. It's a thing.
It is a thing. Although I think many people are starting to pay more attention and they're awakened to the woke movement. Steve, you look like you want to say something.
No, I don't want to say anything, but you got me stirred up here thinking all this from people who have been identified as really hating America and, the whole idea of our founding. And you want to ask the question, what is their true knowledge of the rest of world history leading up to our founding? How much do they really, really know? And what is it they truly hate about being here? You want to, I had offered to buy them a ticket to anywhere else in the world that they would like to go.
Well, and I think what is so concerning now is that there are people that are in places of power in our country that seem like they don't like our country either. And so we are at a time. I was talking with one of our listeners yesterday, and I'd seen, I can't remember what show it was, but Charlie Kirk was on, founder of Turning Point. And somebody asked him about Donald Trump. What was Donald Trump exactly? And he said, well, he could have either been a tremor, which is, the movement before an earthquake. He could be an earthquake, or he could be an aftershock. And he said, I think he's a trimmer. And that would mean that we are, I think, having this great awakening about what has happened to our country. And the solution to it is to reclaim our founding. People have said, go back to our founding, and that sounds like we're moving backwards instead of forward, but to reclaim our founding of limited government and this idea that all men are created equal with these rights from God of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And I think that there is a real movement awakening for those policies. What are you seeing out there when you're talking with people, Lauren?
I'm seeing a mix, but, you know, I'm sitting here just thinking of a story I watched yesterday about what's happening in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And the tent cities and, you know, beachfront property that was once high value and still probably has a high value to it, but now it's just covered by people. And they were trying to help this
with poor, tents and things, right?
Yeah, and they were trying to help this veteran. They took him to the VA just like we would think, and the VA offered to house him and everything. And he said, well, unless you have, you're within a mile of the oceanfront, I don't want to be here. And they're talking about, like, these people need help, but they didn't really want help. And it's just crazy when I see what's kind of happening right now. I don't even know how that ties in, but
I don't know either. And it's some of these great, beautiful places that are, and it's, again, it's because of policy. Mm-hmm. And I know. I think, you know, let's go to break. When we come back, I want to talk with Lauren about the housing market, inflation, interest rates on homes. He has some really interesting information that ties into what we were talking with Karen Levine and Lee Brown about last week. Before we do that, though, another great partner of the show is Hooters Restaurants. They have 5 locations: Loveland, Westminster, Aurora, Lone Tree, and Colorado Springs. And they have Kids Eat Free specials on Saturday and happy hour specials. And then I find this is really great. They have $8 lunch specials, $9 lunch specials, and $10 lunch specials. And those are for to-go or dine-in. And so go to my website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com, and click on the Sponsors tab. I highly recommend each and every one of them. Do business with them. And on the Hooters tab, all these specials will come up. We're going to go to break. Lauren Levy's in the studio. We'll be right back.
Home ownership and private property rights help you build wealth for you and your family. RE/MAX Alliance award-winning realtor Karen Levine understands this. Supply is super tight right now. This is why you need a seasoned professional with excellent negotiating skills on your side of the table, whether buying or selling an existing home or buying a new build. As a member of the National Association of Realtors Board of Directors, Karen Levine volunteers hours of her time to help you build your American dream. Call her today at 303-877-7516. Again, that's 303-877-7516.
You'd like to get in touch with one of Kim Munson's sponsors, but you can't recall their phone number. Find a full list of advertising partners on Kim's website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim, MONSON.com.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I'm Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there, and you can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. Thank you to each and every one of you who contribute to keep our independent voice on the air. We search for truth and clarity by looking at issues through the lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something's a good idea, you should not have to force people to do it. And it is never compassionate to take other people's stuff, their rights, their property, their freedom, or their livelihood via force. It used to be with a weapon, and now we've seen policy, unpredictable and excessive taxation, fear, coercion, or the new one, and that is government-induced inflation. And Lauren Levy, you're in the mortgage industry. Interest rates continue to stay low. That's probably the one spot we haven't really seen interest rates inflate, if you will, or go up. Why is that?
So, you know, when I'm in this every day, it's kind of second nature to me, but sometimes it's easy to forget that the average person doesn't know why things are happening the way they are. But the Federal Reserve has tools, right? They have monetary policy that they can use versus fiscal policy that Congress uses for taxes and things. And a couple of the tools that the Federal Reserve has been using for years is they're out there purchasing United States Treasury bonds and they're purchasing mortgage-backed securities rather than leaving it up to Wall Street to buy them all. And so by being that buyer of last resort, there's always a buyer. And when you create demand, the price of something goes up. And the yield, in this case, being the interest rates, goes down.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Federal Reserve is out there every month, I think, buying $40 billion of mortgage-backed securities. I don't know if they actually spend $40, but that's their offer. So every time mortgages are put together and parceled together and sold off, they're the ones buying them. And that demand is there. And until they start to do what they call taper or buy less, we're not going to see rates really rise. Eventually, they will. They call that tapering, and they'll go to $30 million a month, $20 million a month until they eventually get out. But they've been in since 2009 as a buyer. So the rate, that's why rates have been low. They perk up and down every once in a while, and then they come back down. And that's why even the interest rate on a 10-year note is like 150 still right now.
Okay.
Because they're buying those treasuries.
Okay. Now, Lauren, back when I was in the investment business a long, long time ago, I would look at these pools, these Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac pools, and I couldn't quite understand it. Again, I was a bit of a novice at the time. They said that they were not like a government bond, but they were close, that they were backed by not the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, but close.
Mm-hmm.
It was an implied guarantee, if you will.
That's right.
So Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have been in the market for many, many years. Why is that? Why didn't we just leave it up to the free market?
I don't know what the answer is to why. I just know that they didn't. And, you know, I have my own opinions, and I just have to stress that's what they are. But uh-huh. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac for years now have been what's called in conservatorship. So they're basically owned by the government. They're trying to free them back up. They don't, you know, their stock used to trade publicly, and then it didn't, because the government became the owner. And when you look at it, Fannie Mae is backing these mortgages as well as Freddie Mac. So that is that implied guarantee you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
that lenders, when they sell them to them, if they meet certain criteria, which is what we call underwriting standards, as long as those standards are met, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac will back those loans. So that takes the risk away from the lender. But that the profit on those loans, to the tune of like $75 billion a month, is going into the U.S. Treasury from Fannie and Freddie, and why would the government want to give up that income?
Right, probably they wouldn't.
That's why they're not releasing them out of conservatorship.
Okay. Is there any individual banks that offer mortgages?
There are, and those are what we call portfolio loans is what the term is. Those are usually jumbo loans or loans that have they don't meet what's called a qualified mortgage standard that the government put out there. Could be someone who doesn't have to prove their income. Those loans are starting to come back a little bit, but they're not backed by the government. Those are individual banks out there that are taking on more risk of their own.
Okay. What would what the interest rate would be on something like
those
that?
Those are going to be, you know, even them, because they can borrow money so cheap when they go to lend it, they're not as high as you would think.
Uh-huh.
You know, but they're higher, so they might be in the threes or fours.
Okay.
But they're not at six or seven.
Okay.
Because they're borrowing money so cheap on the other end.
Okay. And if people out there, well, there's such a low inventory of housing now.
Mm-hmm.
And when we had Karen Levine on last week and Lee Brown, and Lee's in North Carolina, they're both on directors of the National Association of Realtors. Karen's another great sponsor of the mm-hmm. show. We talked a little bit about BlackRock has been coming in and buying a lot of homes. And it's so interesting. We talked about it in the morning, and then Tucker Carlson talked about it that night. But this isn't anything new. It was new to me, and I thought, oh, this is new news. But you said, oh, that's been happening for a long time. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear that was a thing right now, that people were just realizing this, because in my mind, it's been going on for a long time. And I just showed you an article from it was written in 2019, but it was referencing 2012. And, you know, it's one of these things where the good intentions might have gone wrong. But
it happens a lot with government.
It absolutely does. And unintended consequences. So back in the time, if you remember the recession of 08 and 09, and, mm-hmm. you know, maybe not in Denver, we definitely had a ton of foreclosures here, but we usually had investors willing to buy them. But in a lot of cities, they didn't. They just had blight and homes that were at risk of just sitting. And so in the government's idea, they thought if they could get investors to come in.
So the government then owned them. What, is that when people just walked away from them? Or?
Yeah, or got kicked out. Usually walked away, lost jobs or whatever, mm-hmm. couldn't make payments. And these are FHA loans that are backed by the Housing and Urban Development Department of the government. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac backed loans that are under conservatorship, right? So it's basically the government.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have these swaths of homes, and they were having trouble finding individuals to buy them. So they allowed companies like BlackRock to bundle them up and come in with I don't know, a billion, whatever dollars they came in with, and buy a million homes at once in one big swoop. And that happened in like 2012. That's a decade now that's been going on, that these hedge funds have been coming in and buying homes with cash. And it's one of the ways wealthy get wealthier.
Okay. And what kind of a ROI, return on investment, would you say that they're getting on that? Because able to buy them lower. And
for sometimes, depending on the city, for cheap, right? Even even here in Colorado, where we didn't have it, I have investors that I did loans for. One area in specific that I can remember is the over where like the Children's Hospital is now and Anschutz Medical Center over there in Aurora. I had several investors buying over there in 2010, 2011, homes that were, I don't know, $130,000. And they didn't have to do much to them as far as clean them up and turn them into rentals. And now those homes are worth probably somewhere in the 300s. I mean, just look at housing prices in Colorado.
Well, and then an ROI, so they're renting them out. And so they're able to rent them out for more now because housing stock is where it is. And so that's probably one place where these big investment firms can get some yield, because you can't get it in the bond market. There's more risk in the stock market. And so this was new to me that they were in. And what Tucker was talking about, and what my concern is that this is they're not going to probably sell if it's a good investment, and we're not building more. And so it's pushing people out of home ownership. Have you seen that at all, Lauren?
I don't know that on a micro level that I've seen it. It might be on a more macro level that he sees things. But, you know, you and I and Karen have talked about real estate being the biggest builder of wealth, right?
Right.
And so if you look at anybody who might have bought one of those homes for $130,000, and yes, they have someone paying them rent, so there is some ROI there, because you don't have to put as much down to buy the house, or cash was making nothing, right?
Right.
Because money markets and banks aren't paying anything, so then they collect that rent and there is ROI, so they get dividends along the way. But your ROI really comes into play when your $130,000 house gets sold for $350,000 and you just tripled your money, let's say, in 10 years. That's a pretty good ROI.
Right.
So I don't know if they have to sell these properties. I don't know how their fund is set up and what they've told their investors. But if you just look on paper at the ROI on that, even just the value of the fund, if they don't sell that ROI, you know, if you're making, I don't know, in 10 years, you know, 10, 12% a year, more, 20% a year on the value of the home plus a dividend, that's a pretty good ROI.
It really is. So my concern, though, is that it is pushing people out of home ownership, because we're using, when we talked with Randall O'Toole, we're with these urban land boundaries that Boulder has it. We see it in a lot of the metro communities here in the Front Range. Is then that then limits the building that can occur. So you reduce supply, you increase demand, and prices go up, and it makes it more and more difficult for everyday people to get into the housing market.
Absolutely. And where it really hits is inventory, right? And I'm sure that's what you and Karen were talking about, because these guys, I'm dealing with a couple right now that's I have them qualified for a loan, but they're not a strong borrower. They don't have a huge down payment. They don't have a lot of earnest money. And I'm afraid that they're going to continually lose, because what these funds are cash buyers. Right away, boom, they don't need a loan. So they look at them as being stronger. They have deeper pockets. So if they have to go $10,000 higher or $15,000 higher or
$50,000
higher, it's not that big of a deal. So you are seeing these people selling homes at $75,000, $100,000 over list. And it really reduces inventory for the families that are trying to buy homes, is what I would think it would do.
Do you think this can continue?
I get asked that question a lot, and I think it depends on your locality, because people are moving here. We know that. You talk about it on the political side of things, right? Moving here from California, and what's that, what that's doing, or Texas, or people trying to escape the salt tax things in New York and coming here. I mean, I just had a new neighbor move in from New York, and I'm sure they paid cash without even asking them. So here in Colorado, people keep coming and coming and coming, so why would the demand go down? Even in 2008 and 2009, we never had a crash like Phoenix or South Beach in Miami. We just kind of leveled off for a while. We didn't have the same crisis that Detroit had, because people want to be here. And it's, for our weather and just our... Our lifestyle.
I am concerned because I have a lot of people that I know that are moving out because of the political landscape. And I think sometimes we take beautiful places for granted, like Colorado or like California, what they're doing there. And eventually you'll get to a point with bad policy that people will move to some place with better policy. That's why this whole idea of America with all of these different states of a petri dish of competition, that Texas is different from California, Florida is different from Colorado, so that people can actually move where they want to be.
And I agree with that. That's how you see states go from blue to purple to red or the other way, right?
Right.
Because of people moving in or out. But the question is, are more moving in than are moving out? And which way is it going? And I agree. I have people that I know that have left. But, you know, Nashville seems to be a good place.
Yeah.
You know, but I think more are coming in than are going out right now.
Right now. Okay. Well, that voice that you hear is Lauren Levy. He is a valued partner of both the Kim Munson Show and America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. And kind of what's your final words of wisdom before we get into the conversation with Josh Phillip in segments 3 and 4?
I mean, I guess my final words of wisdom is, if you're a buyer, be patient. You know, you have to know what you're getting into and talk to your realtor about what to expect and make sure you build a strong offer. One of the ways to do that is to be rock solid qualified before you go out, so you know exactly what you can afford and what you can go over. Mm-hmm. And if you're sitting out there, I talked to a gal yesterday, who's in a mortgage at 5.375%. And I was like, how much money have you been wasting each month, basically? You know, and we locked her in at 2.8.
That's a
huge deal. It's $600 a month that she's been paying to a bank that's now going to stay in her bank account. So the opportunity is still there, and I would stress to people to take advantage of it.
What's your phone number?
303-880-8881.
That's 303-880-8881. Lauren Levy's in studio. We're going to go to break. When we come back, we'll talk with Josh Phillip. You know him. He is an award-winning investigative journalist with the Epoch Times, also the host of Crossroads. Stay tuned.
With the federal government printing money, it looks like inflation is on the horizon. That is why you should lock in a low rate now on your mortgage. Lauren Levy with Polygon Financial Group is here to help. Lauren works with a variety of lenders to assist you in finding the mortgage that is just right for you. Locking in a low rate now will save you thousands of dollars over the life of your loan. Don't procrastinate. Don't wait any longer. Call Lauren today at 303-880-8881. That's 303-880-8881.
Would you have ever dreamed that freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of assembly, and freedom of religion would be under assault and attack in America? Unbelievably, it is happening right before our eyes. That is why it is important to keep free-thinking, independent voices on the airwaves, the internet, and social media. Kim Munson is one of those important voices. Help her keep independence alive. Go to KimMunson.com to contribute, to join Kim in the battle of ideas raging in America today. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
And welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there. You can email me at Kim@KimMunson.com. And thank you to each of every one of you that support us. And in studio with me is a great sponsorship partner of mine, and that's Lauren Levy, Polygon Financial Group. I learned a lot in that last segment. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm glad.
And Josh Phillip, speaking of learning more, Josh Phillip is on the line. He is an award-winning investigative journalist with the Epoch Times. He is the host of Crossroads. Josh Phillip, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kim. Always good being here.
You've been busy. A lot's happened since we last talked last month. And first thing, I think it was one of your interviews on Crossroads that the interview, the premise of it was that the grassroots is really awakening and will defeat socialism here in America. Tell us about that.
Well, I think it'll challenge socialism. Defeating socialism would be wonderful, but I think that's where the battle in this country is going to be very soon. You know, it's interesting to watch. I've been going around the country lately, traveling for my show, Crossroads, as you mentioned, and talking to people who are with Republican Party mostly, and kind of getting an idea of how they're positioning themselves for 2022 with the midterms. And I mean, across the board, people are saying that they're getting turnout like people showing up at the door and saying, you know, how can I help? What can I do? More so than they've ever seen. And even going to conferences, and I go to a lot of conferences in the U.S., I mean, you just listen to the conversations that are going on all the time, and it's people coming out of the woodwork saying, what can I do? I just started this organization with my friends and so on. It's becoming a phenomenon in this country. And the interesting thing about it is, as you mentioned, it's really taking socialism, countering socialism as being the main angle. You know, I remember 4 years ago, I mean, if you talked about communism in this country, people thought you were like, you know, still living in the 60s or something. They thought you were crazy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
These days, it is the central biggest topic in the country that people are really concerned because they see it happening, that socialism and its goal of communism is the main narrative, I think, challenging the freedoms we have.
Josh, but this has been a long time in coming. And we now have a fourth branch of government, which is the administrative, the bureaucratic state. And these people are not elected. They're not accountable. They're appointed. They have agendas. They live off taxpayer dollars. They have big salaries, big pensions. And this is a really difficult thing to walk back. But I think people are realizing that this is a problem. But this has been a long time in coming. And with what we see with the Harris-Biden-Obama-Rice administration, that it's going to be really difficult to get that turned around. What do you think?
Well, I'd agree with you. I'd also say that it's been there probably longer than we think it has.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, when Trump was running for office, he really said one of the most dangerous things a person could ever say if they want to run for office. And that was, I am going to drain the swamp. Because that set off every single person who is part of this system where they know it's corrupt to an extent. I think they make excuses that that's just how business is done in Washington. I think this it's become so accepted in terms of how politics work internationally that, you know, the idea of not giving bribes to other countries and not paying off foreign leaders, because in a lot of countries, bribes are just normal practice. The idea of not stuffing your pockets with insider trading or whatever, because a lot of government officials can do it, is just unthinkable. It's just how things are done. And the idea that if you don't take that, you know, money handed across the table, so on, the next guy will. And they're going to probably push you out of office because they're going to get the union backers or whatever else. This has become the standard way of doing business in this country. And yes, there is, you know, the deep state or whatever you want to call it, of permanent bureaucrats who've become very cozy in their jobs and very used to that lifestyle and very used to that system. And when you have someone coming in and saying that they want to dismantle that entire system, first off, they're going to say, well, who are you? You know, you don't know what you're doing because of international politics and, you know, this is how things work and so on. But you're also going to have them realize, oh, hey, you know, I don't want to go to prison. We got to take this guy out. And this is where the battle has been the past 5 years, 5.5 years now. And I mean, you saw when Trump came in that even a lot of the Republicans were against him. It was really the midterms under Trump when a lot of them got pushed out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the real difference, though, now is that, you know, and again, I'd say this goes back even to the 60s and the Cold War and everything. Ideological subversion has been going on for a long time in this country. Arguably, even before that, you can go back to even like the late 1800s, in fact, when you had the anarchy riots across the U.S. and you had socialist movements, arguably with greater grassroots support than you have now. I mean, this has been a long time coming. But I'd say the big difference, though, is that people are finally waking up to it. I think people across the board are waking up to it, and more so than ever, I think people on the grassroots are looking to really push back in ways they've never pushed back before, i.e., ironically doing what the left often does, which is, you know, community organizing and these types of things.
Josh, I think the difference is, though, from what I've seen is freedom people, there's, like you mentioned, there's all these different groups and so many people concerned, but it's difficult to get them to coalesce together. It's more like herding wild horses versus over on the socialist side. You see now the radical activists that have taken over the Democrat Party. They have, ultimately, they'll coalesce around winning. And it's difficult, I think, over on the grassroots side. What's your recommendation on that?
Well, I've seen that. And there's also a lot of distrust, I think, among conservatives, funny enough. You know, and as you mentioned, it is the freedom people. Because when you have people who believe in freedom, they tend to be different from each other. But you tend to have individuality. You have different beliefs. You have different political viewpoints. You have different lifestyles. You have different, vastly different characters. And oftentimes people who are conservative, meaning they're a bit stubborn and set in their ways, which is a good thing, you mm-hmm. know, but they're different. And to work together, you need to sometimes put aside your differences. I've seen it. I mean, you look at groups like the Phyllis Schlafly, the Eagles, for example, which is a religious organization, you know, religious-ish grassroots kind of movement. You know, I think they bridge the gap between the Mormons and the Catholics and the Christians, because even among the religious community, you don't have cohesion. A lot of them don't see eye to eye. They have different beliefs. And the idea of them working together is a bit unheard of, you know, used to be. I've actually seen a lot of those differences get put aside. I've seen a lot of people putting their differences aside. But even when you come to, like, the real anti-communist movement, like the dissident communities, even going back to, like, the Soviet dissident communities, a lot of them don't trust each other. A lot of the real famous anti-socialists, like Galitzin and these guys, I know people who knew him, I mean, they oftentimes didn't trust each other. They either didn't agree with each other's analysis, or they thought the other dissidents were spies. And I mean, there's a lot of distrust, and that is a symptom of people, of course, having free will and free thought and free belief and having different viewpoints and not having the lockstep one ideology to run everything that the left often has. But I do see, again, people setting aside those differences because they're seeing what's happening in this country, and they're saying, well, these differences aren't going to matter pretty soon if we don't do something.
Right.
And I think that's where it's at.
Okay, Josh, after the election of 2020, and once Biden was declared the Electoral College winner, I saw something, a really interesting phenomenon that occurred, and that was that there was really a movement in the Republican Party that basically said, that was reaching out to grassroots people and saying, Trump is gone, forget about him, that's over, and we just are going to have to coalesce around this new idea, and we're going to focus on the economy, stay away from social issues, and Trump's gone, just forget about it, he'll be ineffective. And we've actually seen that, you know, Paul Ryan out at the Reagan Library, Peggy Noonan, they're saying, you know, move on, it's the economy that matters. And then what happened was, is Trump didn't totally go away. And I just have found this a really interesting phenomenon that's going on, but there was immediate pressure on the grassroots to just forget about it and move on. Did you see any of that?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is what I think they were hoping would happen. Now, a lot of people don't know, I think, what happened on June 6th, what really happened.
On January 6th?
January 6th, yeah. I can give everyone kind of a brief background of what took place based on people I've talked to who were actually part of the meetings that had taken place right before all that. Basically, January 5th, one day before the Electoral College votes were counted and people stormed the Capitol building, you had Trump and a whole bunch of other folks have a big meeting. I mean, I think there were 11 different senators who were there. I don't want to name people because they probably don't want to be named at this point, but you had a lot of the top players within the Trump team who were there. I mean, it was something like a five-hour meeting. And the discussion was around what Mike Pence should do on January 6th, because remember, we had electoral college votes, dueling votes from 17 states.
Mm-hmm.
the media, the mainstream media or legacy media, wasn't talking about that. But you had dueling electors from 17 states. Or was it 7 or 17? I can't remember at this point. Enough dueling electors to overturn the election. And all Pence had to do was open those or choose to open those rather than the main votes. The problem was, what is the impact going to be on the country? After all those deliberations, the final decision they had come to, according to people I've talked to who were in those meetings, the final decision they had come to was that they were going to ask Mike Pence, the decision was at the end, that he was going to send the votes back, and he was going to see, they were going to do a rapid audit of the elections, where they were going to take the voting machines, do a rapid audit, put them back. In other words, kind of like people were talking about using the National Guard and all this stuff. It was going to be like a light approach with that, just to do the audit of the machines, put them back, and then determine which votes get unsealed, the dueling votes or the main votes. Pence actually agreed to do this, according to the individuals I talked to. And then it wasn't until the 11th hour, right before things happened, that someone talked to Pence, allegedly, and he changed his mind. And that's what happened when Trump heard that same day, January 5th. I was very distraught in January 6th when he gave his speech in a somewhat hopeless manner, knowing that the decision had been changed on Pence's side, allegedly, from a very reputable source. And that is what actually happened. But I think the idea of the Republicans, including maybe Pence, and I'm just speculating on what he's thinking here, of course, was basically that Trump would fade into behind the scenes, and that he would take a muted stance and just kind of quietly support the Republican Party. That the Trump phenomenon within the Republican Party, that many of the business guys and so on, especially those doing business with China, did not want. And when Trump, of course, was pushed out, that didn't happen. Remember, they were saying, Trump, get behind the Republican Party. We need your support. This is too important. We need you, but we need to be together on this. And Trump said, nope, you get behind me, because the American people support the movement that I started, this MAGA movement, and that is now the Republican Party. And that has been the shift, this very unanticipated shift, even I think within the establishment Republicans, not to mention the Democrats. And the media and the whole political establishment now has it in their interest to try to pretend that's not happening. And I think that's where things are at.
It is. I think that your assessment on that is absolutely correct. And so now we have all the grassroots that are trying to figure this all out. And and the big money is still over here on the establishment side. And so it's going to be a really interesting phenomena to watch. One other thing, Josh, I had interviewed John Eastman, who was Trump's attorney. And he said that, and actually you can go to my podcast, I have it, but on January 4th, there was a meeting between him and Trump, and then Pence and Pence's chief of staff and Pence's attorney. And I think he said that Pence's chief of staff, I think he said he was an anti-Trumper, which I always kind of found that interesting.
I've heard this also.
Okay. Yeah. And basically, Eastman, in the way I understood it, he said to Pence that I don't think constitutionally that you could just unilaterally say that Trump, that these votes don't count here because there's these states are in flux. But what we would like to have is just some extra time for the state legislatures that were just coming back into session to be able to take a look at what happened on those different states. And they thought that Pence was going to give him maybe a week to do that. And then on the 6th, he didn't. So I didn't know about this meeting on January 5th. What's your final thought on this before we go to break? Because I wanted to ask you about Fauci's emails as well. So what do you think about that, Josh?
Well, I've heard the same thing, and I've heard they believe, we can't say for sure, that it was his chief of staff who talked him out of it on January 5th. So I really think that, again, they thought Trump would fall in behind the Republicans, that the Trump movement would start, and they could just basically pretend Trump never happened. Really, when Biden came in, all of his executive orders just reestablished the status quo, just reestablished where they were before Trump, and they wanted to pretend, I think, even internationally with diplomacy, that Trump never happened. And the media is going to be in a tough spot going into 2022, because as soon as Trump reemerges on the political scene, they're going to have a choice. Do you cover Trump or do you not cover Trump? If they cover Trump, they give him a bigger platform than Biden. If they don't cover Trump, it means all the alternative media get all the coverage, and people are going to want that. And so they're going to be in a tough spot. And you've already had a lot of states doing election law changes, especially these swing states, where a lot of the problems that happened in 2020 aren't going to happen in 2022. Already laws have been changed in many states, not to mention the audits. And so things are heading in a direction that I think the establishment doesn't want it to go in. And they're going to have the, I think, very difficult challenge of choosing, do you cover it or do you not cover it? Because, again, if they don't cover it, all the alternative media are going to be the sole voices on it.
Boy, we're in fascinating times, Josh Philip. Let's go to break. Lauren Levy's in studio. Before we do that, though, Castlegate Knife and Tool, located right here in Sedalia, Colorado, family-owned business. Hal Van Herke, Linnea Van Herke, really are champions for small business as well. They have knives from all the best blade makers from throughout the world. And it is Father's Day, great place to do your shopping for your father, whether or not he is a chef or a collector or a sportsman. Castlegate Knife and Tools, the place to go. Check them out, castlegate.com. That's castlegate.com. We're talking with Josh Philip with the Epic Times and host of Crossroads. Lauren Levy with Polygon Financial Group is in studio. When we come back, I want to ask Josh about Fauci's emails. Stay tuned.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for a weekly newsletter there. Email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. And thank you for supporting us as well. We appreciate it. Lauren Levy's in studio. You said you learned a lot that last segment, huh?
Yeah, Josh is very knowledgeable, and I'm learning a lot just sitting here listening.
There's a lot of information out there. And Josh, you are an investigative journalist, and I would recommend that people check out Crossroads as well. Want to change subjects to Fauci's emails. Fauci was really almost godlike through the initial part of the COVID-19 Wuhan, China virus reaction, disruption, the whole thing. But these emails are really interesting. What's your thoughts on that?
Right. So Dr. Anthony Fauci has been the one advising. I mean, he was Trump's main guy when it came to policy on the virus. And remember, Biden really campaigned on criticizing Trump's policy on dealing with the virus, and then just so happens to bring into his administration the guy that Trump used to create the policy for dealing with the virus. In other words, things didn't change. Dr. Anthony Fauci now is under the, I think, in a very tight place, maybe between a rock and a hard place, because his emails have now been released, at least partially. They are redacted, so we don't know all the details. But what is most interesting in them is that he had it in his interest to prevent international investigations into the origin of the virus, and specifically into the Wuhan Institute of Virology in China, which was this, you know, advanced laboratory where they were researching the most deadly viruses known to mankind, and which was receiving millions of dollars from the U.S. and from other countries that Dr. Anthony Fauci was aware of because it was going through his government organization. They were concerned that international discussion, it seems to be the case based on his emails, they were concerned that international discussion on the origin of the virus, especially as it relates to that Wuhan Institute of Virology, would start a discussion around the money that they had been giving to that laboratory for that research. And a lot of the cover-ups, when they started censoring this all around the world, seemed to have been initiated based on Fauci and his discussions with groups like the World Health Organization, organizations like Facebook, and so on. And so they are in a very difficult spot because of this. And one point on this as well, if they actually cared about stopping this virus, if they actually cared about doing something about this, the very, very, very first step would be to find out what the animal reservoir was. I mentioned this in my documentary last year, investigating the origins of the Wuhan coronavirus, where I detailed, ironically, all the stuff that's coming out now that got censored by Facebook. We got 100 million views before Facebook censored it and, you know, told everybody it was fake, even though all the findings are being proven true now. The very first step you would need to do is find the animal reservoir, because until you do that, you can't really stop it. You can't start dealing with it. And if it was a lab origin, and especially if the U.S. or other countries were involved in financing the research that created the dang thing, then you would need to find out what that is so you can start creating countermeasures and a cure to help countries prepare for it. Fauci prevented that from happening. In other words, not only were they not trying to allow investigations that would allow us to deal with this virus, they had it in their interest to prevent people from finding out what this information was, these key details that you would need to deal with this virus. And a lot of people are in, I think, very difficult places, including Mark Zuckerberg, because there's, based on the emails, it does look like Zuckerberg was censoring people on behalf of the government, meaning it's not private business censoring. It is government censoring through the medium of a private business.
Okay, Josh, people have said that because we're talking about big tech and Ron DeSantis down in Florida is doing some things regarding trying to maybe bust that up or make sure that they have free speech. And then people say, well, they're private businesses. And then I've heard the term freedom of speech, freedom of reach. What's your thoughts on this? If he was actually censoring on behalf of the government and we have proof of that, that's a whole new thing here in America, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's a bunch of nonsense in reality, the idea that this isn't censorship. And there's a few reasons for that. If they're receiving special privileges by the government, then that means, especially as it relates to censorship, especially as it relates to content and content moderation, like Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, that means that they're using a government policy as the vehicle for censorship, meaning this is a government policy creating the window for censorship, giving them legal immunity so they can censor people. The argument that it's not government censorship is nonsense. And ironically, it's being pushed by people who claim to oppose big tech and big business and corporate oligarchs who seem to have no problem watching big business cooperate with big government to eliminate their constitutional right of free speech. It's insane. And I don't know if they understand their own hypocrisy on this. I mean, it's really bizarre watching people who claim to oppose these types of things support it when it supports their own political interest, you know, when it supports their own power grab. In addition to that, a few different parts to this. Not only do they have special privileges and other programs tied to the government, like the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, which gives them legal immunity in terms of content moderation or content and such, meaning you can't sue them for many things. But they also get, again, direct orders for censorship, it appears, like we saw happen with Facebook, which does constitute government censorship, meaning mm-hmm. violation of your First Amendment rights, mm-hmm. meaning constitutional violations. But it also includes things like one of the things that Dr. Shiba has uncovered in his court cases, because he's going after Twitter and so on. Twitter had to testify, they had to bring someone in, because he's challenging some stuff happening with the elections with them. They revealed during the court cases, and one of the Twitter reps actually said this during her testimony, that they give government officials special accounts where they can report content. And there's evidence being brought up in court right now that some of the stuff that was brought up wasn't stuff that would, it was actual true information. But government, because they have this special privilege, special accounts with Twitter, they can report even accurate information and have it censored by Twitter, meaning government is using these platforms as a vehicle for censorship. And what do you call it when government and the corporate structure are working hand in hand to strip people's rights? This is actual fascism. Like that's actually, in terms of policy, how fascism works. And the fact that people aren't putting two and two together on the side that claims to oppose these things is mind-boggling.
Wow, Josh.
But at least it's coming out.
Well, yeah. for sure. And you guys are doing such great work. We have just about 45 seconds left. Josh, what's your final thought you'd like to leave with our listeners this morning?
Well, I'd say, you know, one of the big points a lot of people mention is, I talked to an individual, Trevor Loudon, he's an expert on communism, telling him basically that, you know, it feels like everything is under assault right now. What do people do? And he made a very important point, which is one of the key agendas, first steps of creating a communist system is demoralization. You destroy people's hope. You destroy people's faith. You make them think that there's no chance of doing anything, and they sit back and watch it all happen. He described a lot of what's happening right now as shock and awe tactics. Uh-huh. They want to shock people, do things quickly, do it big, and make them feel that they're powerless in front of all of this. But that is not the case. Okay. The majority of people in this country, I think, really, you know, are on the side that we're on, I think, in terms of, I think, having traditional values and good values and kind of think like this. Okay. And really, I think that there are groups using media and so on, social media, to try to make you think otherwise. And so there is hope.
There is hope. Josh Phillip, thank you so much. And he is with the Epic Times and host of Crossroads. Lauren Levy, great to have you in studio.
Thank you so much.
Okay, and our quote for today is from Joseph Goebbels, and he was the propaganda minister for Hitler. And he said, to be a socialist is to submit the I to the thou. Socialism is the sacrificing the individual to the whole. My friends, today be grateful, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, live honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. My friends, you are not alone. God bless you, and God bless America.
The views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker, commentators, hosts, their guests, and callers. They are not necessarily the views and opinions of Crawford Broadcasting or KLZ Management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.
KLZ AM HD Denver, AM 560 and 100.7 FM.